the slides on the video screen, please? Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Today, I would like to talk about a class of algorithms called recursively squares. We'll actually approach that by beginning a discussion of how to apply Newton's method to the LMS problem. And then we'll also look at a solution called recursively squares, and then at the end we'll sort of compare these two approaches and contrast them. And we'll find that they're pretty similar, and this is going to look like more of the same than the kinds of things we've seen before, but it'll give you an idea of how all these different approaches to estimating these adaptive filter coefficients begin to look fairly similar. They differ in some subtle details. Provided some links here. This last paper, I think, is pretty interesting. When you take the pattern recognition course, you learn a lot about kernels and kernel theory. We spend a lot of time on that. And this last paper talks about a fairly new area called kernel-based recursively squares. I mean, new in the sense of it's much newer than at the time the textbook was written. The textbook was written in the early 1990s, and kernels really came into prominence in the late 90s, early 2000. So I think that's a nice paper to read if you want to see how we've extended these techniques beyond that. Now, I hope towards the end of the semester we'll actually maybe talk a little bit about how we weave kernels into this whole process of adaptive filtering. So, and we'll see how that goes. So, let's begin today by first reviewing a very simple but very powerful technique known as Newton's method for finding the zeros of a function. Newton's method is always somewhat special to me because that was actually the first thing I ever programmed on my calculator. And I was actually a student in the days when programmable calculators first came online and were popular with students, and there was a lot of excitement because you could have this little computer that you could program, and one of the first things we did on our computers was to program Newton's method, which you could program in about 10 steps on these old TI calculators. So, but it's a very, very powerful technique. The main challenge with the steepest descent approach of the LMS algorithm is its slow and non-uniform convergence. What that means really two things. One, we always have this problem of how to set the step size. If you set the step size aggressively, you have a tendency to oscillate. If you set the step size conservatively, then it takes a long time to converge. We also have a problem of non-uniform convergence, meaning that you may start converging quickly, but then convergence may slow over time. The rate at which you converge is a function of time, and that's why people try to set the step size to be a function of time. But all that is, there's a lot of heuristics involved in that, and it's not very, it's data dependent often, et cetera. Newton's method is a very powerful way that gives you a very, very direct convergence. And we'll actually see that that's sort of a drawback in terms of recursive least squares approach. But the basic idea here with Newton's method is that we use all previous data, and we are going to try to estimate a derivative and use that derivative to project, to iterate, essentially. Another concern of the LMS approach is that we use a single instantaneous point estimate of the gradient. We take something proportional to E of n times X of n. And in some sense, we say, well, that's good because we're adapting to very short-term changes in the signal, but in some sense, that's bad because we lose the ability to smoothly convert. So we talked about alternate approaches using block estimation, and that's a good way around this problem. As we'll see with Newton's method, we try to get around this by projecting a derivative, making a projection based on a derivative. And that derivative, in theory, if you're going to compute that derivative exactly, requires access to all the data. So Newton's method is considered an approach that uses all previous data and to iterate. So formally, Newton's method, you've probably been introduced to this in the context of finding zeros of a function. So let's just quickly review that. So consider a function having a single zero. F of s, x is equal to zero at some value x star. The way Newton's method works, we start with an initial guess x sub zero. The next estimate is obtained by projecting the tangent to the curve and projecting where this crosses the x-axis. So over here in the lower right, we have a drawing of this. Here we have our guess for x zero, and this we show the point at which we show f of x zero and x zero comma f of x zero. So the point at which x zero sits on the curve. And what we do with Newton's method is we take the derivative at that point, which is shown by the dotted line, and we project. Screen's a little sensitive today. And we project where that derivative crosses the x-axis. And that's what we use for our next estimate of the value of x at which the function is zero. If we overshoot that point, you can see that the derivative will in turn change sign and point us backwards. So this method is based on the fact that the function should show some kind of convex behavior in the neighborhood of the value at which the function is zero. And therefore, these derivatives, these slopes will change sign and you'll be able to iterate and converge on that point. So the next estimate is obtained by projecting a tangent onto the x-axis and finding that intercept. And we can write an equation for the slope at x0. That's just going to be the value of f of x0 minus x0 minus x1. And if we solve this equation for x1, we can write that x1 is equal to x0 minus f of x0 over f prime of x0. And this is nice because this tells us the value of x1 given the value of x0 and given information about the value of the function at x0 and the derivative of the function at x0. Now the derivative, we can write a iterative equation for this. We can write that xn plus 1 is equal to xn minus f of xn divided by f prime of xn. So it's a very simple way to iterate to find the value of x that produces this zero. The only real catch is that you need an estimate of the derivative you need a functional form for the derivative, which for analytic functions like polynomials and such, that's not such a big deal, but for time series analysis, that's a little bit more of a problem. We have to find a way to estimate the derivative. And once you throw that in, then this starts to look like many other gradient descent algorithms. Now, we want to today apply this to the problem of adaptive filtering. So, to apply this to the problem of least squares minimization, you might think at first, well, we'll just try to find the value of the coefficients that make the error equal to zero. But the problem with that is that we can't really guarantee that the error is going to be zero. The error could be some minimum value, but some non-zero value. So, and we don't know what that non-zero value is, so we can't really set up a function which is the function minus that non-zero value is equal to zero, and then we could use this approach. So instead, what we do is we apply Newton's method to the gradient of the mean squared error. And we use Newton's method to find the value of the parameters that produces a zero for the gradient. And that's essentially what we want, because that's how we find the optimal value of the coefficients. We differentiate the error, we find the critical point at which the derivatives are equal to zero. So we're going to use Newton's method to find the point at which the gradient of the mean squared error is equal to zero. Now, since the mean squared error is a quadratic function, the gradient is linear, and hence convergence takes place in a single step. And that's kind of an interesting result with respect to applying Newton's method to this problem, that we can actually get the optimal solution without essentially any iterations because the gradient function is a linear function. So let's sort of see how this works. Noting that the error signal E of n is equal to D of n minus our parameter vector F sub n transpose times X sub n, our data vector, we can write our error function J as being the expectation of the squared error. Well, that's just going to be the expectation of D of n minus F sub n transpose X sub n squared. We've seen that before. And in previous work on this, we've shown that that's equal to sigma sub d squared. If you just basically multiply out this this square and take the expectations of each of the components, we have sigma sub d squared, which is the variance of d of n, minus 2 times fn transpose times g of n, plus f transpose times the autocorrelation matrix r times f sub n. So we have these three terms, the cross term f and g, and then the last term is it's sort of a quadratic form with the parameter vectors. So we find the optimal solution of this by equating the gradient of the error to zero. So we take the gradient of J, which means we differentiate J with respect to the filter coefficients F sub n. And we've done that before. This term goes to zero. The first term, the middle term, just gives us 2 times G, because the derivative with respect to F sub n is equal to 1. And the last term is a quadratic form, so we just get the 2 times R times F sub n. So the gradient of J with respect to F sub n is 2 times R times F sub n minus 2 times G. And we set that equal to 0. And as before, we find our optimal solution is the F star is equal to the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix times G. Now, what we're looking for now is a way to estimate, to iterate on estimating the coefficients F. And there are a couple ways to do this. The way the book does it, which isn't perhaps the greatest from a teaching perspective, is they postulate the form of the solution, and then they show that that form it does in fact produce a solution of the optimal solution. So if we postulate this update equation of F sub n plus 1 is equal to F sub n minus 1 half R inverse times the derivative of J with respect to F sub n, we can easily show that if we substitute for this derivative what we just derived here, that that will in fact produce an optimal estimate. So we take this equation, fn plus 1 is equal to f sub n minus 1 half r inverse, and then for the derivative of j with respect to f sub n, we substitute in this term here, the 2r f sub n minus 2g. And when we do this, we see that the r inverse r's cancel, so we have essentially fn minus fn, so these terms cancel, and what we're left with is R inverse times G, which is just equal to F star. So what this this shows is that if we use this update equation, it will produce in, it will produce essentially this optimal solution in one iteration. So we're sort of verifying that this is in fact the correct update equation. Now there's other ways to get at this. Like I said, the book chose this particular technique. So this is our update equation, but there's a problem. The problem is that this update equation still requires an estimate of the autocorrelation function and an estimate of the derivative. And the estimate of the derivative is in terms of the autocorrelation function. So, and to estimate this autocorrelation function, theoretically, we need access to all of the data. So, we're still not quite there yet in terms of a realizable update equation. So let's talk about how we can estimate the gradient using Newton's method. So in practice, we can use an estimate of the gradient, which is related to En times x of n. That's essentially what we did for the LMS gradient. If we use this, the update equation becomes Fn plus 1 is equal to F sub n minus 1 half R inverse, and then we substitute in for the gradient this minus 2 E of n x of n. And that gives us Fn plus 1 is equal to F sub n plus R inverse times E of n times x of n. And that's an equation which starts to look familiar because we got something similar with the LMS algorithm. The only problem with this equation now is we have to compute the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix, which is really bad. So we'll do a little bit of work on that to get rid of that. Now, we recognize that this is a noisy estimate of the derivative, since it's just a point estimate. It's using the current value of the error and the L previous values of the signal. So, and we've shown previously that in that case, we're going to accumulate a excess mean squared error. So to combat this, we can introduce an adaptation constant and write that Fn plus 1 is equal to F sub n plus alpha times R inverse E of n x of n, where alpha is a constant between 0 and 1. This allows us a little more graceful convergence because we're, with alpha being less than 1, we're essentially allowing this thing to gradually converge, much like we've done with most of our iterative algorithms. Of course, by doing this, convergence no longer occurs in one step, because we have this term alpha, which introduces a bit of bias. And we analyze the implications of that with the LMS algorithm. We talked about the fact that alpha produces a bias, but it also gives you smoother convergence. So it's a trade-off between well-behaved convergence and bias. And this is also now looking very similar to the LMS algorithm in its the way it converges and the way it adapts. And we still have to worry about estimation of the autocorrelation matrix. Not only do we have to worry about estimation, but we have to worry about the inverse of that estimate. So inverses have a way of magnifying any errors in your estimate. So so this is sort of a double hit, because not only do we have to worry about a noisy estimate, but when we invert that noisy estimate, the estimate of the inverse is probably going to be even worse. Now, to compare this solution to the LMS algorithm, we can rewrite the update equation in terms of the error signal. The error signal being d of n minus fn transpose xn. So we take this equation, fn plus 1, which is equal to f sub n, plus alpha times r inverse, and then for e of n, we plug in the expression for the error signal, which is our desired signal d of n minus the parameter vector f sub n transpose times x sub n, and then we have that quantity multiplied by x sub n. And we've actually done this before when we derived the LMS algorithm. And we can restructure this by factoring out things that are related to F sub n and things that are related to X sub n. So for F sub n, we have F sub n minus, we have a minus sign here, alpha R inverse, we have xn times xn, we'll invert that and write xn, xn transpose, and then we have, instead of, have the, here we have an f sub n, here we have an fn transpose, so if we basically flip the order of transposition, we can write this as xn, xn transpose fn. So we have then two terms related to f sub n, and then we carry this additional term, alpha r inverse d of n times x of n. If we take the expectation of both sides and invoke independence, we can write that the expectation of fn plus 1 is equal to 1 minus alpha times the expectation of f sub n plus alpha times r inverse g. And that comes from, this term comes from taking the expectation of d of n, x of n, which is g. This term, we have the expectation of xn, xn transpose. Well, that's just r, so the r's cancel. So we're left with a very nice, very intuitive expression, which says that the expectation of the new estimate of the coefficients is equal to 1 minus alpha times the expectation of f sub n plus alpha times r inverse g. And we can further note that if we set alpha equal to 1, if we don't do this forgetting factor, as we called it, then we can write that the expectation of fn plus 1 is equal to r inverse g, which is just our optimal solution. That's our LMS solution. So this is a very nice expression for that very nicely characterizes the performance of this estimator, because it shows that it's in terms of 1 minus alpha times our current estimate plus alpha times our optimal estimate. And it shows you how over time this is going to convert, because we're essentially mixing these two estimates. So this tells us, the expectation of fn plus 1 tells us also something about the bias of the estimator, because that's that the expectation is essentially what the algorithm is going to converge to over an infinite amount of time. So the applying Newton's method to this problem of adaptive filtering gives us a solution which looks very much like the LMS solution, except that we have this inverse autocorrelation matrix to deal with. And that's a problem both from a computational point of view and a theoretical point of view. From a computational point of view, you'll notice that this inverse correlation matrix is not a function of n. So you can say, well, that's not too bad. All we have to do, if we know a priori the autocorrelation matrix, we can compute it, invert it offline, and then it's essentially a scale factor in this equation. But there are better, but in practice, of course, we don't know what this matrix, and we have to estimate that from the data, which means to do this right, we're going to have to incrementally update our estimate of the autocorrelation matrix. And the last thing we want to do that is to have to compute a completely new autocorrelation matrix every sample and invert it, because one matrix inversion per sample would be prohibitive. Okay, so let's see if we go a little further on this. Let's analyze the convergence property of this estimator. So we can look at essentially the error vector associated with the error in estimating these coefficients. And we did this before in our LMS algorithm. We can define a vector U, which is going to be the expectation of F sub n minus F star. F star is our global solution, which we don't, with R inverse G, which we don't really know, but we can assume if we had access to truth, we could compute the autocorrelation matrix and compute the optimal value of the coefficients. And E of Fn is essentially the expectation of our estimates as a function of n. So this equation is essentially, if we look at the difference between Fn and our global solution, R inverse G, and we write it in terms of a vector U sub n, we can write that un plus 1 is equal to 1 minus alpha times un. And we did this before with the LMS algorithm, and this is a first order difference equation whose solution is essentially the initial condition, the error in our initial estimate, U0, times 1 minus alpha to the nth power. This is just a first order difference equation. Its solution is of the form a to the n, an exponential. And so this is the error is a function of n. It's really the expectation of the coefficient estimate. So it's sort of a smoothed error. And we can observe the following from this, as we did with the LMS algorithm. The algorithm converges in the mean if this term has a magnitude less than 1, which means that alpha has to be between 0 and 2. Convergence proceeds exponentially at a rate determined by this 1 minus alpha. That's essentially the strength of this exponential. If alpha is close to 0, convergence is slow. If alpha is close to 1, convergence can be fast. This also tells us that the convergence rate of each coefficient is identical and independent of the eigenvalue spread of the autocorrelation matrix R. Now that's, and because we essentially use the same value of alpha for all the coefficients. And that's a significant difference between LMS, because if you recall, when we did an analysis of the convergence rate of the LMS algorithm, we showed that that convergence was a function of the maximum eigenvalue, and we showed that therefore the rate in which the algorithm converged depended on the eigenvalues of the autocorrelation matrix R. Well, here, because we're essentially computing the auto, we have essentially in our estimation equation, we have the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix. We remove that dependence on the eigenvalue spread of the autocorrelation matrix. So we end up with a result which shows that the convergence rate of each coefficient is independent of the eigenvalue spread of the autocorrelation matrix, because the coefficients are computed using the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix. So we sort of normalize out the variations due to the eigenvalue structure. However, as we've said, we still need to worry about how we go about estimating this autocorrelation matrix. And we have a couple things we can do there. The autocorrelate, the elements of the autocorrelation matrix are defined by the sum from L is equal to 0 to N of XL minus I, XL minus J. That's actually more of a covariance formulation, but that's typically how we compute the elements of this autocorrelation matrix. And for the values of X that are less than 0, we will typically assume that Xn is equal to 0 for N less than 0. Actually, you can assume that they aren't 0, and you can retain them. If you're implementing a frame-based approach, you can actually retain the values of the signal from the previous frame and use those in the computation. So there's no real need to do this. You can compute the autocorrelation function several ways. And so we can write this now as a function of something we'll call R sub n inverse, where R sub n is computed this way, and we can actually write this computation as a product of XL, XL transpose, to put it in sort of in a vector form. Now, the problem still is, so now we can in fact compute the autocorrelation matrix as a function of n, but the problem with that is that then we're going to have to invert the autocorrelation matrix every sample. Now, you can in fact compute an update of the autocorrelation matrix fairly easily, because if you think about this, if you compute the autocorrelation matrix at time n, and then you have an additional data point arrive, there's only a minimal amount of updates that need to be done to all of the sums that you've previously computed. If we go back to if you look at this sum, when the n plus first data point arrives, you essentially have one term that needs to be added to all these sums that you've computed, which represents the contribution from the newest data point. So, and the reason we like to write this sum in this form is because that makes it fairly easy to show that we can actually write Rn plus 1 is equal to R sub n plus the data vector at n plus 1 times the transpose of the data vector. So we essentially add the contributions due to the most recent data point. Now, this gives us a way of computing the autocorrelation matrix iteratively. But you'll also notice that this is essentially computing the autocorrelation matrix using all of the data. It never forgets any of the data. So there are some options that aren't discussed in the book for doing this, but one of the things that we can do here is actually add alphas, 1 minus alphas, and do a sort of exponential weighting or a forgetting factor, so that the autocorrelation function is a smooth estimate of, and so that it does not simply accumulate all the data for all time. But what we want to really focus on with this approach is how you can estimate the matrix inverse in an iterative way. So we're not going to worry about estimation of the autocorrelation matrix as much as we're going to worry about estimation of the inverse in an iterative way. So let's go a little further with this computation. To reduce the computational complexity of the inverse, we can invoke something known as a matrix inversion lemma. It turns out there's a very interesting property of matrix inversion when you have a situation where you have a matrix plus some incremental contribution to that matrix. And the matrix inversion lemma says that if you have something of the form A plus U, U transpose, where U and these are vectors, A is a matrix, and you want to invert that, this is equal to A inverse minus the ratio of, in the numerator we have A inverse U, U transpose, A inverse, divided by, in the denominator, 1 plus U transpose A inverse U. Now, we won't prove this today, but this is one of the, you know, this is a property of matrix inversion. You can find it in a linear algebra book. So if we apply this matrix inversion lemma to our update equation for the autocorrelation function, what we're going to do essentially is derive an equation for the inverse at time n plus 1 as a function of the inverse at time n plus this new contribution xn plus 1. So we can write that the inverse of rn plus 1 is equal to the inverse of r plus xn plus 1 times xn plus 1 transpose, that quantity inverted. Okay, so we're essentially simply taking this equation and using it to write an equation for rn plus 1 inverse in terms of rn. Well, this quantity, rn plus xn plus 1, xn plus 1 transpose, we can use the matrix inversion lemma to write this as rn inverse minus a quantity, which a ratio of two terms. The numerator, we have rn inverse xn plus 1, xn plus 1 transpose, times rn inverse, and in the denominator we have this 1 plus xn plus 1 transpose rn inverse xn plus 1. Now this is, you know, another one of these amazing little things, right? It all seems to be rather convenient that it works out this way, but this is really amazing, and I think this in itself is one reason why this derivation should be interesting to you, is that you'll find when you actually go to do kind of numeric computation, that almost any computation can be cast in this kind of iterative framework. And this is a really powerful computation because it says the inverse at time n plus 1 is equal to the inverse at time n plus, or minus in this case. Now the denominator term is a scalar, because this is x transpose times a matrix times xn. This is actually a scalar. And the numerator term looks sort of like an what's called an outer product. So this is a fairly inexpensive way to compute the matrix inversion iteratively. This computation is also proportional to L squared rather than L cubed. A matrix inversion, if you do use any of your standard algorithms like, Gaussian elimination or whatnot, is proportional to the dimension of the matrix cubed. So matrix inversion is computationally expensive. This update equation is proportional to the dimension of the matrix squared or the length of the filter because we have essentially just dot product. We have matrix times vectors, and both of those are of dimension L. But the more important observation here is that note that we never explicitly, this allows us to never, we never explicitly compute the autocorrelation matrix. All we do is seed it with some initial guess, and then we iterate with over time with this equation. So we compute the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix directly, and we do that iteratively in time so that this update equation now does not require us to really compute the autocorrelation directly. It's just another scale factor, or in this case a matrix, but another scale factor that has to be computed as a function of n. So we can summarize the overall algorithm, putting all these things together now, we can summarize the overall algorithm for computing computing the adaptive filter coefficients using Newton's method in a time, in an iterative way. We can summarize that as sort of two steps. We start with an initial value for the filter coefficients and for the autocorrelation, the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix, and I'll say a little bit more about this in a moment. And then for n equals 0, 1, 2, and so forth, we do three things. We first update our estimate of the autocorrelation matrix, the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix, and we do that using this equation that we derived from the matrix inversion lemma, and that equation just says it's a function of our previous value minus this correctional term. We then compute the new value of the error as the desired signal minus the filter coefficients at time n multiplied by the data vector x sub n. And then now that we have r inverse and e sub n, we go ahead and update the filter coefficients using rn inverse and e of n. And then we can go back and iterate now. Take these as our current coefficients and repeat. So it's a fairly simple iterative solution for finding the coefficients of our adaptive filter, but the principal difference between this and the LMS algorithm is that with this approach, we're multiplying by the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix. So you can think of all these adaptive algorithms using derivative approximations are essentially a first order difference equation where we have the new coefficients are equal to the old coefficients plus some scale factor times E of n times x of n. But where these algorithms differ is in the way you compute this scale factor on that correctional term. And with Newton's method, we use this inverse of the autocorrelation matrix as part of it's essentially folded into our step size here. Now, there are a couple things you can do to initialize the autocorrelation matrix, but what's typically done is to assume it's an identity matrix and where all the elements are of the diagonal have an equal value, and to choose some small positive constant for those values. And you can sometimes get a good estimate of this assumed by looking at the environment. You might, for example, estimate the background noise or things like that. But it's not too sensitive to the choice of this initial condition because it will converge fairly quickly. Now, what are the drawbacks of this approach relative to things we've already studied? Well, if you might recall, we looked at linear prediction, if you remember, and we derived some update equations for linear prediction that were whose complexity were order O of L, where L is the length of the filter. The complexity of this update equation is order L squared because we have this matrix times vector type products in this matrix in this computation. So this is computationally more expensive than what you might say is state of the art. In fact, this solution historically was developed fairly early before a lot of these more computationally efficient algorithms emerged later. So it was at the time it was developed considered important, but I would say, you know, it's been superseded by some of the recursive in time algorithms that we've discussed more recently, which have order O of L type complexity. And in fact, we'll look at one of those in a moment And then next class, we'll continue looking at more efficient ways to solve this equation. But what's nice about this equation, it gives you a lot of insight into how the autocorrelation matrix plays into the process of adapting the coefficients over time. Okay. So let's now sort of switch gears and talk about a second algorithm in the same family. This algorithm is called recursive least squares, and we'll end up with, in this case, a very similar update equation, but derived under slightly different conditions. So in this case, we're going to consider minimization of a finite duration version of the error. Our goal is going to be to minimize not the expectation of the error squared, but to minimize the actual error squared over n samples. So we'll define the error as the sum from L is equal to 0 to n of e squared of L. And e squared of L we can write as the sum from L is equal to 0 to n of d of L minus y of L, y of L being the output of our filter in our adaptive filtering scenario. The objective of the recursive least squares algorithm is to maintain a solution which is optimum at each iteration. That simply means that the objective here is to try to compute the optimal solution to this equation at each time instant, given the data in hand, rather than trying to iterate to that optimal solution over time. Now, that's a sort of subtle statement if you're not familiar with recursive algorithms, but there's really kind of two approaches to recursion. You can take an equation with a static amount of data, and you can iterate towards the solution of that equation. With no new data, you can just take an equation and derive an iterative algorithm which you can run on a computer, and you can essentially, over so many time steps, find the solution to that equation. That's one sense of an iterative algorithm, and that's actually what some of the algorithms we've discussed do. But in signal processing, it's also of interest to us to iterate over time as more data arrives. So the recursive least squares algorithm tries to produce the optimal solution at each point in time rather than converge to that solution, because we're thinking ahead to situations where the signal is non-stationary and we can't really afford to iterate over time because the signal is going to change. So we want to take the data in hand and get the best solution possible. So we can take this error, we can differentiate it, and that will lead to our normal equation. We've seen this before, where R sub n, which is the autocorrelation matrix defined over this interval of n samples, times F sub n is equal to G sub n. And R sub n, the elements of the autocorrelation matrix are defined as usual by a sum of XL minus I times XL minus J, and the G vector is just the cross correlation between the output and the input, between the desired signal and the input. We've also noted that we can write recursive and time equations for Rn as a function of Rn minus 1 and Gn as a function of Gn minus 1, because these sums can essentially be restructured to be the previous sum plus some incremental contribution due to the newest sample. Now, we seek solutions. We sort of know that the solution to this equation is Rn inverse times G sub n, and we would like, as we said, because our objective is to maintain a solution which is optimal at each point, we want to make sure that the values of the coefficients that we're computing are always R inverse, whatever our current estimate of R inverse is, times Gn. So what we can do is we can apply the matrix inversion lemma to the computation of the inverse here. And we can write that, again, if we take the inverse and using our what we did in previously with Newton's method, we can write that Fn plus 1 is equal to this updated estimate for Rn plus 1, which is in terms of the previous value of Rn inverse minus this rather complicated term involving the outer product divided by this scale factor. And then we can also write that in terms of Gn plus the new contribution to Gn, which gives us Gn plus 1. Now, what we're going to do now is try to sort of understand the nature of this equation by defining some intermediate variables so that we can reduce the equation to something which looks a little more familiar to us. So let's first define an intermediate vector variable, which we will call z. And z is equal to Rn inverse times xn plus 1. So we can take this equation and we can write that Fn plus 1 is equal to Fn minus z times xn plus 1 transpose times f sub n. And remember that the Fn is equal to Rn inverse times g. So what we're simply doing is multiplying this out, substituting for Fn Rn inverse times g, and then we're also replacing everywhere where we have Rn inverse times xn plus 1, we replace that with z. So what that gives us, we have two terms here times two terms, which gives us four terms. So the first term is going to be Rn inverse times gn, which we call Fn. The second term is going to be the product of these two, the second term in the first sum and gn. And if we work through the substitutions, we end up with a term which has z xn plus 1 transpose times f sub n divided by this 1 plus xn plus 1 transpose. And then for this Rn inverse times x, we simply substitute z. And then the third term is going to be dn plus 1 times xn plus 1 times Rn inverse. So for the Rn inverse xn plus 1, we substitute z, and we just have d of n plus 1 times z. And then the last term is this thing times this thing, and we can actually write that as z, as dn plus 1 times z times xn plus 1 transpose times z. That's just taking this stuff with xn plus 1 and making the substitutions for z. And then for the denominator, we again have the same thing here, 1 plus xn plus 1 transpose times z. It's a little bit, you know, just trying to clean this up to make so we can understand the form of this equation. Now we can define another intermediate scalar variable called k, which is going to be xn plus 1 transpose times z. We said this is a scalar term, so we're going to call this piece of that sum in the denominator k. So we can write that fn plus 1 is equal to f sub n minus the quantity. And what we're going to do now is combine this term with this, this term. So we have, for the denominator, we have the 1 plus k. For the numerator, we have xn plus 1 times f sub n times z. That comes from here. We have this dn plus 1 times z, which comes from here. But I'm a little bit worried. We're missing that this term associated with the z xn plus 1 transpose z. But I think that, oh, that's right. Okay. So we have, so this first term here, this xn plus 1 transpose times f sub n comes directly from this term. Here, what we need to do is to be able to combine these two, we have to multiply by 1 plus k over 1 plus k. And then when we collapse these two, that will collapse to just dn plus 1 times z over 1 plus k. So the difference of these two terms is equal to just dn plus 1. I didn't show that here, but I probably should expand that to show that simplification. So this gives us fn minus, and now we have, if we now unfold this and make our substitution for z, we can write this as fn plus 1 is equal to f sub n minus this term, and this term has in the numerator xn plus 1 transpose times fn minus dn plus 1. In the denominator it has 1 plus k, and then that's times rn inverse times xn plus 1. And what we'll do is we'll move this minus sign inside and interchange the dn plus 1. So we can write, we can define an error term, e of n plus 1 over n is equal to d of n plus 1 minus fn transpose times xn plus 1. That's just this term here. So our update equation becomes fn plus 1 is equal to f sub n plus, we have this scale factor 1 over 1 plus k, and k was just xn plus 1 transpose rn inverse times xn plus 1. And then we have times this error term, en plus 1 over n, and then we have the rn inverse times x sub n plus 1. Now this error term is called the a priori error because it reflects the fact that the error is obtained using the old filter coefficients and the new data. So this is essentially an estimate of what the error will be at n plus 1 given the coefficients at n and the new data point xn plus 1. So this is called the a priori error. And again, we see that the recursive least squares algorithm, now it had a little bit different than what we saw with Newton's method in that the update equation, it's still a first order update. It's still in terms of a correction term times an error signal times xn, but the form of that correction term is a little different. In the denominator, we have this xr and inverse x type structure. And then in the numerator, we have a projection for what the error will be at the n plus first step given the coefficients at n, and that's why they write it in this n plus 1 slash n format. And then we also multiply by the inverse of the other correlation matrix. So this is a summary of the recursive least square algorithm. We initialize our estimate of the filter coefficients and our estimate of the autocorrelation inverse, and then we iterate for n equals 0, 1, 2, and so forth. We compute a new estimate of the error signal based on the new estimate, the new desired value of the desired signal minus the old filter coefficients times the new value of the signal. We compute an update, essentially our adaptation step size as 1 over 1 plus xn plus 1 transpose r and inverse times xn plus 1. And then we go ahead and update the filter coefficients using the old value of the filter coefficients plus our step size alpha of n plus our error term e of n plus 1 slash n times r and inverse times xn plus 1. Now you'll notice there's a sort of a key thing here, which is that the new filter coefficients are computed in terms of the previous estimate of the autocorrelation matrix. So once we have this, then we go back and we update the autocorrelation matrix using an equation we essentially derived from the matrix inversion lemma. The new value of the autocorrelation matrix, the new value of the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix is equal to the old value minus alpha of n times this outer product. And then we can go back and iterate. So we can, this is the iterative algorithm for the recursive least squares, and what I've done here is copied the one we derived previously using Newton's method. For Newton's method, we compute an estimate of the error. We compute an update for the filter coefficients, and that update is based on a fixed step size alpha plus times this autocorrelation inverse times E of n times X of n. And then we go back and update the autocorrelation matrix. And then we iterate. So the RLS algorithm can be expected to converge more quickly because we're essentially using a much more aggressive weighting step size on the correction term. And that step size is computed based on properties of the data. So this is a nice sort of summary of the difference between these two algorithms. The algorithms, all these adaptive algorithms are very, very similar. They're of the form fn plus 1 is equal to f sub n plus some correctional term. And the correctional term always has the error times the signal. But the difference here is with the recursive least squares, we're using an adaptation step size that's inherently adaptive. It's inherently a function of time. That allows us to, in a sense, set a more aggressive step size because it's going to adapt to the signal. With the Newton's method, we're essentially just using a global fixed step size, which is computed to be optimal in the global sense, but not optimal in the local sense. Now, I think that's the last content slide, if I'm right. Yeah. So, in the textbook, they have a couple pages where they work through an example. It's a reasonable example, but I don't think the examples are but I don't think the example basically shows you that the RLS algorithm converges faster than Newton's algorithm, and that's why RLS is much more commonly used than Newton's method. But there is one additional enhancement we can make to this algorithm. When you have a non-stationary signal, the process of weighting all of the data equally may not be the best thing to do. Because if you want the filter to adapt quickly to local changes in the signal, when noise arrives, you can think of it this way. When you get a noise burst, if you weight all samples equally, the contributions of that noise burst are going to be small relative to the total history of that signal. So the filter is not going to do a good job of adapting quickly to that noise. So one of the things that's done is to introduce a weighting factor on the air, and to have that, and you can, you know, postulate many different forms for this weighting factor. In fact, you can think of this in the general case as a windowing process. And, you know, if you remember your windows, you have all sorts of windows, Hamming, Hanning, you've got exponential, triangular, and that's really all they're doing here. In the context of recursive least squares, it's common to use a sort of exponentially decaying weighting function, which means the near-term samples are going to be weighted more heavily than the older samples. And so if we postulate an error function as lambda raised to the n minus l power, we're essentially doing that, because when l is small, we'll have lambda to the n, and when l is large, we'll have lambda close to zero. So if we postulate this kind of a weighting function, you can go back and essentially re-derive all these equations that we did. And what turns out is a fairly simple modification of the RLS algorithm. We still have the same update equation for the error. The update equation for the step size, though, the alpha of n, now will have this factor lambda. Instead of having 1 here, we'll have this factor lambda. And the update equation for the coefficients f sub n will remain the same. And the update equation for the autocorrelation matrix will have a 1 over lambda in it rather than a 1. So this is sort of satisfying, because if lambda is equal to 1, you can think of that as the case we just derived. If lambda is equal to 1, then these equations are identical to what we just showed for the recursive least square. If lambda is less than 1, we have a slight change in the scale factors here. But the algorithm itself is essentially the same. Now, in terms of computational performance, the RLS algorithm is computationally more complex than the simple LMS, because it is O of L squared. The recursive least squares algorithm has this additional, if you remember the simple LMS algorithm, we just had an alpha times E of n times x of n. And that was order L multiplications to update the coefficients. The RLS algorithm has this additional Rn inverse. So it's of order L squared, because it takes some effort to update our estimates of that autocorrelation matrix. But the RLS algorithm is still less complex than Newton's method. But the benefit of this, you might say, well, what's the benefit of the RLS algorithm versus the simple LMS? The benefit of this is that you can get convergence, which is independent of the eigenvalue structure of the signal, because we are taking into account the eigenstructure analysis, the eigenvalue structure of the signal, because we're pre-multiplying by this Rn inverse. So the RLS algorithm is an algorithm which tries to give you a much more uniform convergence than the simple LMS. And I think that's a subtle point that I'm not sure is coming across, but if you think about the case for a stationary signal, so stationary means statistics don't change over time, the LMS algorithm will give you this nice kind of uniform convergence, because the statistics of the signal aren't changing. So over time, it's learning the autocorrelation structure of the signal, and the coefficients are converging to the true value of the coefficients. But if the signal is non-stationary, the simple LMS algorithm has trouble converging, because it wants to take some time to converge to the true value of the signal. It's using a slower a more conservative convergence rate, you could say. So it never, the signal changes, it starts adapting, and then eventually it might get there, except that the signal changes again. So it's never getting there because the signal is changing. The RLS algorithm is much more aggressive in the rate at which it converges. So when the signal changes, it's going to take all the data in hand and give you the best estimate possible. So it will allow you to get a uniform convergence in even when the signal structure is changing, because it's taking into account the eigenstructure of the signal. It's essentially modifying the weight on the correctional term based on the eigenstructure of the signal. So the RLS algorithm is very popular because of that. It gives you a nice sort of uniform convergence. But that comes at a cost. It's more computationally expensive than the simple LMS algorithm. And, you know, if you've read the article on echo cancellation, and if you ever have a chance to implement the echo cancellers, you can actually see it very nicely with echo cancellers. Echo cancellers work fine when there's no impulsive noise on the line. When there's impulsive noise, you can actually hear in the resulting audio data the time it takes for the filter to readjust. And the RLS algorithm is an attempt to make that readjustment time much smaller by doing this more aggressive convergence. But the RLS algorithm is more computationally expensive, so in the early days of echo cancellation, they couldn't afford to do this because they could not fit it within the constraints of the hardware that they had to work with. So what we've done today is we introduced Newton's method as an alternative to the simple LMS algorithm. We derived the update equations for this approach, and we showed that Newton's method was essentially the update equations essentially used a fixed step size that was a function of the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix. We then introduced the recursive least squares approach and a exponentially weighted version, and we showed that that could give us a more data-dependent, more aggressive update equation involving an iterative estimate of the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix. And we then sort of discussed briefly the difference, the convergence properties, and the computational complexity. Now, what we'll do next time is we're going to constrain the filter structure to be an IIR filter. And we'll show how you can actually derive update equations for the case of IIR adaptive filters. And these are actually used in some very sophisticated line equalizers that were used in telecom when modems were transitioning from about 9600 baud up to about 32K baud. These IIR adaptive filters were one of the reasons they were able to get that kind of improvement. Okay, so that's it for today, and I'll see you on Thursday.